Hello, folks. Hello, hello. How are you doing tonight? I hope everybody's safe, at home, getting some rest. And I'm just waiting for my buddy, Rudy Machiello. There he is. So we can start another episode of Shop. It's been a while, right? So let's wait for Rudy. There he is. What's up, man?
Hey, what's up, guys? Whoa,
Yeah.
I'm kind of
Good.
dark.
You are kind of dark, actually. Yeah. That's cool. I'm the bright side, you're the dark side. Yeah.
Yeah, you're Marvel.
Yeah.
You're
You're
Marvel. I'm DC.
exactly. I'm kind of like the Jedi Order, and you're the Sith.
Yeah.
All right, man.
So from
So how are
now,
you doing, man?
I'm good. I'm good. So from now on, whenever I'm online, I want
Yep.
the song from Darth Vader. Bum, 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 bum.
Oh, I know how to play that actually. We
Oh,
actually played
man.
that a couple of years ago. I was on the trumpet. It was pretty cool. So hello everyone joining us.
Hello, Jenna. Hi,
Hello.
hello. Sania just
How are you
called. How
doing?
are you
Good.
doing? Hello. It's been a while.
Awesome. Let me just close the door here so I think I can get a better. Okay. All right. Cool. And then you can see my paintings. Yeah. All right. So good to be back. It's been a while.
Yeah.
Another edition of Shop Pedagógico for you guys. Thank you for joining us. We're going to talk about something super cool today, I
Yeah.
hope, right? I
Yeah.
think everything we talk about is cool, man. But I'm biased.
Yeah. You know, was that a coincidence?
Exactly. So, but I remember talking to Rudy a couple of days ago, like a week ago, when we were, trying to figure out what we were going to talk about, and then everybody was talking about the coronavirus crisis and, the things that we were watching on TV and getting on WhatsApp and Facebook, social media, and we thought that maybe this is something really relevant for especially today, what we're going through, right?
Most definitely. Of course, we're not going to talk about bias. It's a different kind of bias. But yeah.
Oh, coronavirus, man. No,
No,
you're
yeah, I got you. I choked with water here, you know. That, yeah.
okay,
And
good.
it's true.
Good.
It's kind of, I think the water is going to kill me. But the
Yeah.
thing is, we're going to talk about how people tend to
Yeah.
disagree, but
Yeah.
based, but not because they're not informed, but because
Yeah.
they refuse to agree with the
Exactly.
information, with the reality, or with
Exactly.
proofs and whatever.
Yeah, I mean, this is something that all of us are prone to doing, actually, because this is how the brain works. But this is something that is really concerning most people nowadays because of the amount of information that we have and fake news. And even with the real news, people, they refuse to believe, like Rudy said, because they have something that is very well documented, known in psychology, called cognitive bias, right? So I think maybe we should start with a definition, very short description of what a bias is, because most people do it in a very unconscious way. We don't really know what we're doing. We just kind of go with the flow. We follow that gut feeling that we have. Something comes, from our subcortical areas and tells us, like, this is what is going on, and we are very wrong. We're just like animals. And I remember talking, yeah, we are animals, actually, right? And we have two systems working at the same time. There's a great book by Daniel Kahneman, Thinking Fast and Slow. And he says that, in a very economical, well, actually, he won a Nobel Prize for economics. So he uses a lot of jargon, like, to kind of get into his area, like economics. And then he says, like, thinking fast is all about instinct. It's kind of like subconscious. You don't really think about it. It's really kind of the gut feeling that I said. And then thinking slow is analytical. It's like taking the time to ponder and, you know, work out the pros and cons of something and actually rationalize about it, right? And that can be explained by the dynamic of, you know, the subcortical area, which is like the inside area of our brain. So this is our brain. So my thumb.
Yeah, my brain. My brain. I was about to get my brain. My brain is kind of far. I cannot get it right now. So go ahead with your puppet.
This is my this is my brain, right? So this is the cortex. So that's the external area. And my thumb is kind of like the subcortical area. So it's inside. It's under the cortex, right? And this subcortical area has a lot of different structures, including the limbic system that is responsible for many things like memory consolidation, you know, emotional response and whatever. And that's what is triggered, is activated. It's always activated, to be honest. But this is what really prompts us to do something very quickly, almost as an instinct, just like a cat or a dog, you know. They see something weird, they jump, they run, they do something. They don't have the cortex that we have to rationalize. Okay, wait a minute. Am I being too paranoid here? Maybe I shouldn't jump or attack someone or do something. And that's how the bias works, right? It prompts us to do something very stupid on kind of like an emotional response, like, you know, just, okay, I like this person. He wouldn't lie and, you know, I believe them. Or, you know, I think this is what it should be like, and then you don't really rationalize, and that's bad, everyone. That's pretty bad, you know, because we have to rationalize, right?
Yeah, that's totally bad. And just to complement what you have just said, this whole idea of cognitive bias, you gave us a great overview. We're not getting in depth about cognitive biases here, etc. But then, how are we going to transfer this idea of cognitive bias to to our universe, classroom, students, and all these things?
Exactly. Well,
cognitive bias, as Andre has just said, is a person or people who refuse to believe in information, in real information, just because those people or that person has or have been doing the exact same thing for quite a while.
Exactly.
Basically, is what we call stubborn people.
We're all stubborn. A little stubborn, man. Yeah. You know,
so they're very stubborn. No, but seriously. But that's the whole problem with cognitive bias, because then those people say, I've been doing the exact same thing for 20, 30, 40, 50 something years, and I've been getting some results. Those people must be getting very nice results, but they don't realize that they could be getting better results.
And
that's the whole problem. Yeah. They're not getting the best out of the whole situation, or they're not getting the best of the whole scenario.
And that's, they can't see the whole picture, right?
They can't see the whole picture. Exactly. And then if we're going to transfer this to the classroom, we're not going to talk about classroom right now. Just wait, and we're going to talk about classroom in a moment. But then in the classroom, we have two situations. We have the student who claims that, no, I'm not going to do that. I'm not talking about ages here, okay? I'm talking about students in general. So we have students who say, no, I've been doing this for quite a while, so I'm not going to do this, teacher, because I'm not going to.
This is what works for me, right?
Yeah, that's what works for me. And then we have the other end of the candle, which is the teachers, us. They are saying, I'm not going to do this because I've been doing this for decades and I've been getting great results. That's not how it works. You know, we should always be questioning ourselves. We should always be the main critics of our own jobs, of our own work.
Yes.
Because then we're going to be able to minimize the possibility of cognitive bias, because we all have cognitive biases.
We do.
You know, it's not something bad people only bad people do, professional. No, we all have that.
And you know what's really scary about this cognitive bias thing is that we don't just have one. Actually, I prepared a presentation for the Federal University here a couple of months ago, and I was doing some research, and there is a codex that was powered by Wikipedia and some psychologists, an artist. And so there's a codex with a lot of different biases, and there are like 200 of them. and you know, if you think of, and then just to mention a couple and how they work very quickly, we have the Dunning-Kruger effect, for example, that people who are very incompetent, they don't know that they're incompetent because they're incompetent to see that, right? Basically, you think you know too much about something when you don't really have the skills to know that you don't know as much as you think, right? So that's one thing. And we can mention a lot of famous people, some actually,
there's also the phonological bias, which is the McCrudder effect. We think that we're hearing a sound, but we're, in fact, we're being disguised or, the movement of our lips is not, is making us believe that we're hearing a kind of sound, but as a matter of fact, we're not hearing that sound, or the person is not producing
exactly. I remember Facebook, man. Do you remember the trial with Mark Zuckerberg?
Yes,
so they actually they recorded, they narrated what he was saying, but he wasn't saying that. Yes. But the lips, they moved as if he were, right?
It's the pa and ba. Every time we have the pairs, pa, ba, fa, ba, and all these things, it's we're tricked by the movement of our lips, you know?
Exactly. Yes.
I can, because the whole McCrudder effect, the whole idea is that they're playing a guy, moving their his lips, and there is a sound.
And exactly.
You know, then you're going to follow either the movement of the lips or the sound.
Yeah.
So.
Exactly.
You know, that's a kind of bias.
And we also use our tongue to make sounds, right? And you can't see that. So whatever the lips are doing doesn't necessarily tell us what sound is coming out, right? So and also
that's how ventriloquists work. They work like that, you know.
They
ignore certain sounds that they move their the lips, and they use their tongues or their throats or their glottes, and they're not going to move their lips. Their lips are sealed.
Exactly.
So
it's perfect.
So when we're seeing a ventriloquist or a ventriloquist show, we're actually being biased, phonologically biased.
Yes.
The guy's tricking us because we think that they're producing a certain sound, but as a matter of fact, that guy's not producing that sound exactly.
And you just use the keyword when it comes to biases. It's tricking, you know? Somebody's deceiving us. They're fooling, us. And that's the thing. And then I mentioned the Dunning-Kruger effect. I can also mention confirmation bias, for example. So whenever we're trying to find arguments to support something we believe in, we're going to favor the arguments that support what we believe in, right? So when people come with stuff that goes against what we believe in, then we have the backfire effect. We might believe so much, so deeply in whatever we believe in, that opposite, contrary arguments are actually going to reinforce what we believe in, right?
Yes.
So this will cause some cognitive dissonance, right?
Yes.
And this is how we get manipulated very easily. How, if you go to a sales convention, for example, or coaching or whatever, some religions will use this technique as well. It's the emotional aspect of the event that will make you believe whatever they're trying to sell. And then you feel good. And your brain actually mistakes this feeling good with the desire, the wish to buy something or to do something, right? That's why you get so motivated. So you can get motivated just by jumping around. So if you want to start, guys, if you want to try it out, just stand up, start jumping around, and then try to make a decision. you're going to have that dopamine rush that's going to bias your brain. And then my professor, quick story. My professor, Paul Howard Jones, used to say, if you want someone to fall in love with you, ask them to meet you at a high place. So the rush they get from, scaling or going up, is going to be mistaken, you know, for like, ooh, I'm feeling good with this guy or this girl here.
And you know what? I don't know. For those who don't know me personally, I really like sports. I really like to exercise and all these things. And I really like to go street running. Unfortunately, during this social distancing, I'm not being able to street run anymore. But it's hard because when you go street running, you have to make decisions like crossing or not the street. And when we're tired, man, that's hard.
It is hard.
You look at the cars and you think, no, I can do it. Oh, no, I can't
do it. I can do it.
Okay, I can do it.
That's the dopamine speaking, man.
So that's very hard. But you mentioned manipulation. And this is really important in cognitive bias, especially when we talk about the discourse of people. When we talk about the discourse, there is, it might sound cheesy, but the words have power. The whole core of pragmatics is that words have power.
And most definitely.
And for instance, I gave you this example as we were having this meeting to discuss what we're going to talk about the next episode and et cetera. If I have a man, a boyfriend and a girlfriend in front of me, and I say, okay, guys, so from now on, you're married. I don't have that power. I don't have the power to marry people. My words don't have the same power as a minister, for example. A minister, a priest, or whatever religious leader we're talking about here, they have the power using the exact same words. Now you boyfriend and girlfriend, or boyfriend and boyfriend, or girlfriend and girlfriend, or you know, two partners, two people. Whenever that person says you're married, then those words have the power, you know. And when you say manipulation, if we're talking, if we have specialists, if we have experts, and if we have people who actually understand what they're talking about, there's power. It's inherent in those words. We cannot extract the power from those words.
Exactly.
It's like if I give my, it's different from opinion, for example. If I can give my opinion on, I don't know, quantum physics, quantum mechanics, or electronics.
Sure.
Or information technology. Why? Because I read and I like these things, but I'm not an expert. It's different, for example, if an engineer, or an actual engineer, talks about these things.
Yeah.
It's different, for example, let's suppose that I use Sheldon Cooper all the time because I really like the show. But it's different, for example, if I had a Sheldon Cooper here talking about quantum mechanics or quantum physics, because he's an expert. So whatever
Neil deGrasse Tyson, I'm a huge fan.
Neil deGrasse Tyson,
an astrophysicist. Exactly. Yeah.
You know? So whenever those people say something about quantum mechanics or quantum physics or whatever whatever subject related to physics, there's power involved in that. And we
definitely,
as teachers, when we're teaching a different language or languages in general, we also have that power. We have the power, for example, to create to create the whole meaning of our students. Our students are going, we've talked about meaning creation here a couple of episodes ago, several episodes ago. We've been talking about this. You know, we always end up talking about meaning formation.
Definitely.
Because it's
so important, right?
And it's kind of like my specialization. So when we talk about meaning formation, we have this power. And we have to be careful with this power because we're not going to impose this power. We're not going to say to our students, look, I'm the teacher. You're the student.
Yeah. You know,
We're not Mr. T here. I don't know if you guys remember Mr. T from the 80s.
Fool!
You fool! You fool!
Yes. I remember. Yes.
Go, you fool! We're getting old, you know. If you guys are less, if you're younger than 30 years old, you're not going to remember
the
team or Mr. T, but you're not going to impose that. This comes naturally, okay? This
remember naturally. Hulk Hogan.
Hulk Hogan.
Yeah. Dude, we are getting old. We are getting
old. Super
old.
But, if you don't know who the A-team is or was, who Mr. T is or Hulk Hogan is, Google these guys and they're going to see how famous they were, okay? But that's
you're
going to
see the power of words.
Yeah. So yeah. That's the whole thing with the pragmatics or the power, the pragmatics of cognitive bias, or actually how cognitive bias influence the pragmatics, the words.
And you mentioned something very important, that is the authority figure that we are as teachers, and actually how authority figures exert power on people, right? Because if you go back and you look at some very shady psychological experiments in the 1950s and 60s and 70s, like, you know, those, you know, Ivy League guys, they were pretty, you know,
they were
messed
dark.
Up anyway.
They were dark.
We can't get approval for stuff like that anymore, like ethical approval. But, you know, to mention two experiments, there was one in 1961. I think it was Yale University. So, you know, Ivy League, those guys are super, you know, brainiacs and everything. And this guy, Milgram was his last name. So he decided to test how much power we can exert, you know, when we are an authority figure. Like, will people listen to us, obey us because we have a certain expertise? And then he got an actor with a lab coat, like the white scrubs that doctors wear, right? And a tie, you know, so the guy looked nice and everything. And then he brought some people in for an experiment, and they just said that you're going to have to manipulate a machine or something like that. And then there was another actor in a room, and he was kind of, you know, there were a lot of wires all over this guy, kind of like he was, and he was sitting on a chair. And he was, you couldn't really see the guy. So he just described the guy to the subjects of the experiment. And they had this shock machine that you could actually just discharge electric shocks, you know. And the guy would feel the shocks, of course, right? They could only hear the guy. And the machine said very clearly that, you know, there was a very small electric shock. Voltage, and then, you know, medium, and then finally very high voltage. And there was something like, we don't know what's going to happen if you cross the line or whatever, something like that. And then this guy, the actor, would keep saying, like, the experiment must go on. And then the guy would start screaming, like, ah, you know, every time they turn the knob, like, ah, you know. And then most people, this is weird, most people, like 90% or 80% of the people, actually killed the guy. I mean, they would have killed a person if it was a real situation, right?
Yeah, that was only a simulation, guys. That was a simulation. They haven't
it was a simulation.
Anyone.
Nobody got killed, right? But some two or three guys actually stopped and say, I'm not going to continue that. You have to continue. That's for the good of science. You know, the experiment must go on and whatever. So he had a script. He didn't want to use, you know, other words, so he basically memorized three or four lines, and they said, it must go on, it must go on, you have to do it, whatever. And then they did it, because, you know, I'm here, it's Yale, there is a guy who dresses like somebody who knows what they're talking about, he's wearing a white coat, right? So I have to do what this guy says. And the other one was at Stanford, 10 years later, with a guy who actually won a bunch of prizes. His name is Philip Zimbardo, and it's known as the Stanford Prison Experiment. So basically, they put they got two groups of people. They had never seen each other, ever. And then they set up the basement of Stanford to look like a prison, right? So they actually built cells and stuff like that. And then they just assigned different roles randomly to people. Like, you're going to be the guard. You're going to be the inmate, the prisoner. You're going to be the guard, whatever. They had never seen each other. And then after a couple of days, because they were actually there, they had to pretend that they were the guard or the inmate. After a couple of days, they started acting like they were. So the guards started acting. They were very mean to the inmates, and they actually used verbal aggression all the time. So they were, patronizing everyone. They were not listening to what they wanted. And then the guys who were playing the inmates, they actually felt kind of subjugated, right? Obeying what the guards told them to do. And then why is that? Because there was an authority figure that gave them a role, and then the guards became the authority figure, like
yes,
in a very subconscious way. So that's how the brain works, right?
Yeah.
It's pretty weird.
Yeah, and you know, just to wrap up, if you guys have, do you remember the most famous or the most recent, actually, trilogy of Batman with the Joker was Heath Ledger? The Joker was Heath Ledger.
Yeah.
So at the end of the film, there is the exact same experiment.
Spoiler alert, but everybody watched it, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, that's relatively old. It's from 10 years ago or something. So that's the exact same experiment that the Joker did. You know, in the boat, there were the prisons with the remote for a bomb, and there were civilians on the boat with the remote for the bomb, and the remote for the bomb on the civilian boat was to explode the prisoner's boat, and the prisoners had the remote for the bomb.
The remote,
on the boats of the civilians. So
exactly.
And nobody had the authority to actually say, no, I'm going to explode because of this, this, and that. So that's the whole point of cognitive bias. And actually, sorry, no, that's the whole point. Sorry. That's the whole point of pragmatics, that there is power. Just because the Milgram experiment, just because those guys were wearing scrubs, for some reason they had power. Those scrubs gave them power. And people believed that. So once again, we as teachers, we also have that power. And we also have to be very careful when we're creating the meaning of our students. For example, our students look at us, especially when they are very young learners, they look at us as the main authority in the classroom. So they
as
wait
a role
for
model,
us,
right?
As a role model, exactly. So they're waiting for us to actually guide them through what to do. So that's why basically you don't assign a debate for very young learners, among other reasons, of course. We're talking about cognitive bias here, but that's
cognitive ability as well, right?
Yeah. But that's why, because they're going to look at you, they won't be able to realize, okay, so now it's my turn to talk. Now it's my friend's turn to talk. They don't know that yet. But we can do this because we do have the power. So this is also another pragmatic characteristic of the language, that we as teachers, or as language teachers, we're responsible for transmitting this information to our students, to actually show them, okay, so turn taking, you know. This is really important. So, okay, now it's your turn. Now it's your friend's turn. We do have this power just because we're teachers. We also have the power to, as I said, to create the meaning of everything, to make our students make our students associate the knowledge they already have with the new language, considering that our students, or these students, already have their first language consolidated. So we do have that.
Exactly.
If we don't exert this power
correctly
or properly,
ethically,
we're going to have what we call fossilization. And this is a big problem.
Perfect. And you know, and you mentioned something that, you know, kids, they don't have the ability to kind of know when it's time for them to take turns, you know, because they're going through a phase that is really important to consolidate what we call self-regulation, you know. You know, I actually wrote a blog post about emotional intelligence and how it's really important for us to have a role model, somebody who will co-regulate our behavior to help us, you know, implement, or actually to help us absorb or acquire this ability of self-regulation, right? And this is something that, again, we need somebody to be there presently, to be, you know, telling us what to do. And this person has the power to shape our behavior, to shape some of our attitudes, right? So it could be the main caregiver, could be the mom, the dad, and also the teacher, right?
Yeah.
To tell us what to think, how to think it, and what something means, right? So the power of the word, again, the pen is mightier than the sword, right? So words create meaning, they create reality. And then if you tell kids that this should mean that, and that's wrong, and then that becomes fossilized. So you create a habit in the brain, and it's so hard to break that, man. So you're going to talk about fossilization, but so to give you a cue to start talking about it, if you create a habit in the brain, there is a whole biological process involved, you know. It's kind of like moving in into a new apartment, right? So you get all your furniture from the moving truck, for example, and you put everything outside the door. There's a hallway. And then when you're moving stuff in, you're finding a place to get to put the stuff, right? That's kind of like fossilization, like memory consolidation. So you keep everything in the front part of the brain that's outside the door. That's your working memory. And as you are making things more automatic, so you're automatizing things, you're just moving stuff in, and then you're selecting a place to put all the stuff, right? And then once they are there, because you use, you know, some structures like the striatum, for example, and you use the parietal lobe or the cerebellum, they are responsible for, you know, making habits, right? Automatic behavior. Once they're in and set, it's really hard to move them, especially that huge shelf you have in the middle of the living room, right? Or the cupboard. It's really hard to move them. And then if you have to move them, you have to get someone to help you, right? And that's fossilization because, you know, so if somebody, me, I'm the designer, I'm the furniture, I'm the architect or whatever I tell you, you have to put your cupboard right here, you know? Yeah. And then I do it. And then after a couple of months, I was going to say something bad now. But anyway, I don't like it where it is. And then,
oh, darn.
How do you move it? Oh, darn, you know? I was going to say something, you know. But anyway, it's really hard to move it, right? You have to get someone to help you move it. That's fossilization, right?
Yes. And as a matter of fact, in languages, we have two types of fossilization. We have the fossilization. This is one type. I'm going in depth about this fossilization in a while, but we have this one in which we learn something that way, and we're going to keep doing that because of cognitive bias. Yeah. We don't care what others say. We don't care about new information.
Exactly.
We don't care about information at all. And I'm going to keep doing this for the rest of my life because, you know, in terms of language, I can communicate. Yep. People understand what I'm saying. So
exactly.
I'm not going to change this. And we have another type of fossilization, which is when we don't actually correct our students.
Yes.
So if we don't correct our students, this is going to be there for the rest of their lives because they have absolutely no one to say, hey, come on, no, look, try this way, try that way. So the first type of fossilization, which is the most important out here because it's related to cognitive bias, it's exactly what we're talking about, which is I'm not going to change the way I speak because it's just communication. I do business. Yep. I've been doing business for 20-something years. And they understand, and that's cool.
Yep.
Or I know that a great friend of mine has just joined, and he is an airplane pilot. I've been a pilot for 15 years, 20-something years, and I've been communicating in this way. I don't care if I've been making mistakes, linguistic mistakes, because the crew understands what I'm saying. And the passengers understand what I'm saying. So I'm not going to change. Yep. I'm not going to look for any sort of enhancement or improvement, linguistic improvement. So that's a cognitive bias. And that's what we have with our students, especially our adult students, you know. And Anna, pronunciation. Great. I was just going to talk about this, you know.
Pronunciation, Anna.
Yes.
Perfect.
Because
usage of the verb.
Students, yes, because our adult students have that, especially because they have a lot of background. They have a huge baggage, a huge baggage.
Yeah.
So
they a lot of prior knowledge, like, right?
Yes, and they're going to say, well, I've been saying, let's say that the difference between the short E and long E, like fit and feet. I've been saying feet for fit and feet for feet. And I'm not going to change because people understand what I'm saying. So I'm not going to change that. So it's hard for us as teachers to change that because of what you said. And there is one more thing that you forgot to say, Andre. When we're moving in, when we're moving out of a house and moving into a different apartment or a different house, we also use the back of our brain because we try to use the image of where the furniture was in the old house or in the old place.
Exactly. Well
so
done. Yeah.
We have that image. Yes.
Image processing.
We use our acceptable load because, you know, like, oh, I remember the table was, I don't know, the
kind of like
table
here.
Kind of like here. So I'm going to do it the same way.
Exactly.
So that's it. You know, we also use that image. We also use the acceptable load. Of course, not just the acceptable load. This is just to tell you guys, because Andre mentioned, if I'm not wrong, you mentioned two parts of her brain.
The parietal lobe, the cerebellum.
The cerebellum. Yeah, three.
Exactly.
So you mentioned the parietal lobe, the cerebellum, and the frontal lobe.
Yeah.
And I mentioned the acceptable lobe. So there are four parts of the brain that we use when we communicate. So once again, guys, if anyone, if you've ever heard anyone saying that we have specific parts of our brain being activated when we communicate, for Jesus' sake, I was about to
freak.
Say something. So
well, we have a lot of different areas of the brain activating, right?
So
it's not just one.
One. Okay. Of course, we do have parts of the brain responsible for doing something. But when we communicate, when we use language, we don't use only that part. Yeah. So, for example, the temporal lobe, the left hemisphere, and the temporal lobe, it's dedicated
the temporal lobe.
It's dedicated for semantics, you know? So whenever we're communicating, you guys are watching us. And please don't forget, this is going to be on Spotify as soon as we have the time.
Yes.
Actually, we do have some time. We've been doing a lot of work.
I think we're working more now than before, right?
Yep.
With the whole crisis.
Yeah. We've been working a lot here, but it's going to be on Spotify. Yep. So if you missed or if you have just arrived and you want to watch or listen to us, it's going to be on Spotify and on IGTV on ADC Rocks here on Instagram. Okay. So for you guys that are watching us or listening to us, you're listening to us, you're watching us. So there's a bunch of meaning and involved or carried by our words and our sentences and our chunks and all these things. We use our temporal lobe to understand that. But that doesn't mean that we're just using the temporal lobe. Okay, guys?
No. I can give you an example. Right now, you are probably holding your cell phone. So areas in your parietal lobe, the somatosensory cortex, are lighting up because you can feel the texture, you know, the pressure of the fingers, your fingertips against the phone. You're looking at the screen, so you have a lot of activation in the occipital lobe. You are listening to us and decoding whatever we're saying, so you're going to see a lot of activation in the left temporal lobe, but also the right temporal lobe, because there's intonation there, you know. So it's so much, and you're also trying to imagine when we talked about the furniture, you know, moving into the house. So you imagine the images. So occipital lobe, but you're also using your working memory systems to hold all that information. So you're using your prefrontal cortex. It's a lot, guys. And you're feeling something, right? You know, there's an emotional response. So you're using your amygdala. That's a subcortical structure. So you know what? There isn't a one specific area in the brain that does one thing. Everything we do involves a lot of different areas in the brain, okay?
Yes.
And we don't only use 10% of our brain, so stop saying that.
That's another myth. So, what I'd like to say, imagine that you have light bulbs, so you have the lights in your rooms, and whenever you activate the light is shining, like here, you know, I turn on and off the light. So the brains are the same. So whenever you need to do something, whenever our brains are required to do something, there is a light being activated. So our brains are constantly like a Christmas tree. A lot of lights shining all the time because we're not just doing one thing. Even if we think that we're doing one thing,
I like the analogy.
It's never one thing.
Christmas tree, you know. I like that.
It's like a Christmas
tree. I like
tree.
That. And we also use like a fireworks display, like, you know, a bunch of lights coming different colors. And
yes.
Cool.
So,
and you mentioned men, just to, you know, you mentioned pragmatics and fossilization and everything. And I feel like a lot of, you know, for anything that we do, it's really important for us to start right, you know. To start right, to kind of, you know, get into whatever we're doing in the right way, because that's why a couple of years after, a couple of months after, when you have acquired that and stored in your cerebellum or your parietal lobe or whatever, it has become a habit. It's really hard to change, to break the habit, right? And like you, some people gave examples of stuff that are students they use wrong, right? Because they started learning it the wrong way and nobody corrected them. And they just kept kind of, you know, carrying all over till the point that, you know, you became their teacher and you realize, oh, there's a fossilized, you know, structure that we have to take care of. But then you realize that it's so hard to make it right, isn't it? It requires, you know, a lot of effort.
It requires a lot of effort. And I think that's a great cue for us to talk about the teaching practices, especially right now, and to make a connection with cognitive bias, okay?
Yeah.
Once again, we've been saying this all episode long, you know, so we're constantly coming back to this whole idea of cognitive bias. Cognitive bias is when you refuse to accept an information, an actual information, just because you've been doing something for a decade, for quite a while, and you refuse to do that. Yeah. So you believe you've been getting the best result possible, and you refuse to accept an information and change your behavior, or attitudes, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah. So we as teachers, when we see, for example, a student that has this kind of profile, like, oh, I've been communicating like this for quite a while. I've been using these words for quite a while. So why do I have to change? Why do I need to improve my English? We have to start, we analyze that. And then we need to find different ways to make our students accept this new information. You know,
and that's tricky, man. That's tricky.
That's very hard, because we have to get out of our comfort zone in order to find different ways. So we have to think outside the box to find different ways. And we cannot, and why is that hard for us teachers? Because we also, remember, I said having a cognitive bias is not for bad people only. We all have cognitive biases.
Everyone has it.
Everyone has. So we also have a cognitive bias, and we have to put that aside in order to find a different approach, a different way, a different activity, in order to make our students also remove or put aside that cognitive bias, that linguistic cognitive bias. And that sometimes is really difficult, because, again,
it is difficult.
We say, oh, I've been using... Just one example, okay? A random example here. I've been using a smart board for the last 5 years, and I've been getting the best results possible. And then, okay, but nowadays, maybe we have different resources. We have resources other than just a smart board. So maybe a smart board for a student is not... that effective anymore, because it's not new anymore. It's old news.
Exactly.
So we have to change that. We have to accept that.
Yeah, and there are two very interesting comments here. So Jenna said it's challenging. Oh, yeah, most definitely. And but it's worthwhile if we manage to help the student, most definitely. And Anna mentioned something very important, like mindset. Not necessarily, but we can have a biased mindset. Our mindset can be biased, right?
Yeah.
And just to complement what you said, man, like, you know, imagine, really, Rudy said something very important. Like, we have to find different ways, strategies to get to our students, because it's not easy to break a cognitive bias. And I can tell you right now, the moment that we're living is proving that. Because you know what? We have the biggest authorities of institutions around the world, and even here in Brazil, telling people to stay home. Because, you know, do the whole social isolation thing, because it's important to kind of spread the contamination, the infection over time, so that we can deal with that. And then we can bring evidence, we can bring the opinion of experts. Actually, not opinion, it's actually based on evidence, scientific evidence. And we can show people, we can rub in their faces, and they're not going to stop believing. They're going to say, you know what, I survived the war, so I'm going to go whatever. So because we are somehow very moved by instinct, you know, this is how we have the two systems working in our brains. And then again, it's really hard. So sometimes direct confrontation is not the answer. We have to ask questions like, but why do you do that? Why do you think that? But don't you think that? And then maybe the person will realize that, you know what, maybe I can change this. Mm-hmm. But yeah, that's it.
Yeah, Anna, why is that not exactly a mindset? Because a cognitive bias is something that you don't break very easily. And mindset is more flexible. I'll just give you an example. Yeah. I don't know if you guys know, but I'm a former basketball player. And I still like basketball. I still play with some friends, etc., but not as much as I played in the past. And there was, unfortunately, he passed a couple of months ago. There was a very famous and important player called Kobe Bryant.
Oh, yeah.
And he created what they call Mamba mentality. What's the Mamba mentality, or mindset, as you said, Anna? The Mamba mentality was that we cannot rest, because as we rest, others are working. So we have to focus on victory. We have to focus on whatever we need to do in order to achieve our goals. So that's a mindset. But if this mindset is unbreakable, if you refuse to accept different approaches for this mindset, for example, let's suppose you think, okay, so what's my goal? I want to be the best English teacher in the world. Great. So what do I need to do? Oh, I need to have an undergrad degree, and then I need to get a master's, a PhD, and a bunch of workshops, a lot of certificates, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah. Great. Perfect. And then let's suppose that after some time, a person says, oh, you know, in order to become the best English teacher in the world, you know, workshops and certificates are not important anymore. What you have to do is this, and that, because look, it's proved that this approach is way much better. Okay. Yep. If you accept that, I'm not saying that you have to accept everything. Of course, we need to be very critical, but you know, generally speaking, if you say, oh, okay, so let's try it. You can try it.
Yeah.
Let's try it. That's a mindset. Yep. Okay. But if you say,
it's not a bias, right?
Yeah. But if you say, I'm not going to try it because I've been taking courses, I've been watching webinars, getting a lot of certificates, going to courses, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I'm not going to do this. So that mindset automatically became a cognitive bias. And that's really bad, because maybe if you don't give it a chance, maybe you're not going to be receiving information, useful information for your classroom. There's always someone giving us very important information to bring into the classroom. That's why cognitive bias is so dangerous for us teachers, not just because of the language. And as we said, when we mentioned pragmatics, when we were discussing pragmatics, but also in the practices. Nowadays, a lot of us, actually all of us, are being required to use online teaching.
That's perfect.
If you you know, unfortunately, we had to have a virus, a pandemic, to force many teachers to get out of their comfort zone. Because I've talked to so many teachers saying, and not just now, I've been doing this for 7 years
forever.
Already.
Yeah,
you know, I've been teaching online for 5 years. 5 years.
Yeah.
And I've been telling teachers for seven, guys, you need to start going online. Use technology.
Exactly.
Use resources. Nowadays, we have resources other than the textbook, the teacher's guide. oh, I'm not going to do this because I've been a teacher for the last 20 years and I've been getting great results.
Exactly.
We should
reinvent ourselves. Yeah.
You know,
just like Jordan said. Yeah.
Yes. And nowadays, because of this pandemic, we're being forced, obliged to do that.
If we
had done that a long time ago.
Yep.
This wouldn't be so hard for us right now because we would be like, okay,
dude,
so what are the resources that we have? Okay, so I have Hangouts, I have Zoom. Okay,
exactly.
I have this website that produces mind maps automatically.
I have Google Classroom, MindMaster, Padlet, but so many resources. Yeah,
there are so many resources online nowadays. So we wouldn't be struggling to, what do I do with my students right now?
Exactly. And you touched the nerve now, man. You touched the nerve. Because you know what? This is what I've been getting from the teachers that I work with, teachers that I train, and I understand that it's a struggle that we are having now because it's a transition period. We're trying to adapt to this new reality, and we've been doing things a certain way, and we've created habits, and we've created biases, right? And now teachers are going nuts. They're going crazy. Like, how can I set up a virtual learning environment? How can I find the best platform to use for my students? How can I teach very young learners online? Is that even a thing? So everybody's asking questions and everything. And this is actually, I see it. Of course, I know the negative effects and everybody and everything that's going on, but it could be an opportunity for us to rethink what we've been doing as educators, as teachers, and why our educational system sucks in a way. I understand there aren't resources, really. I understand that it's a money problem as well. It's a structure problem, but also it's a methodology problem. And it's also stepping out of our comfort zone and being able to say, you know what? The things that I've been doing for a very long time might not be as effective for my students because they are part of a new reality. They were born into a technological era, and we have to bridge the gap between what they expect as students in the classroom in terms of technology and what we are delivering, right?
Yeah.
So this is an opportunity for us to break this bias, everyone. Get out of your mind, of your cognitive bias, get your cupboard and put it somewhere else, move your cupboard, move your shelf in the room and start, and then do some, renovate the environment.
Yeah, do some feng shui.
Yes. That's perfect.
And Anna, please pay attention to what Andre is saying. Don't feel frustrated, anxious, or stressed, okay? Continue, Andre, because she said there are many people that have been feeling frustrated, anxious, and stressed instead of seeing this as an opportunity.
That's all on the spot, really. And why are we feeling anxious and stressed? Because this is how the brain works when we're faced with a new situation. Our brain produces cortisol, and we're ready to fight, flight, or freeze. That's the FFF response in the amygdala. So that's a natural feeling, but we have to overcome that. We have to grow, from the subcortical area. We have to be able to access the prefrontal cortex and just analyze and stop and analyze the situation. And for example, there are gains, and we have to look at on the bright side. There are also losses and negative aspects to the whole thing. Like being in the classroom with the students is great, but it's very stressing sometimes as well, isn't it? And then, so you have to look at on the bright side. I can access my students from my home. I can actually record video classes. I can teach online. If I want, I can mute their microphones, for example, so that they listen to me.
Yeah.
So there are advantages, and we have to look on the bright side. And I think the biggest advantage is this is going to make me a better professional. Because I'm going to have this experience. I'm going to have this habit. And in the future, if another pandemic or whatever happens, I'm going to be ready. And because I didn't have the time to be ready until now, now is the time.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. And Anna, just to wrap up, because we only have 6 more minutes here, and we're going to, we can't speak more than 1 hour here, okay? Not again.
Yes, because if we could...
we learned our lessons, okay? But Anna, yeah. Seriously, this is exactly what you asked a couple of minutes ago about mindset and cognitive bias. What you have here is a mindset. What you say, no, Henry, don't worry about it. But Anna, what you have here is a mindset, okay? We're all feeling frustrated because this is a mindset. This is flexible. If we start analyzing the whole situation from a different perspective, we're going to see that this is an opportunity. Unfortunately, it's not
like
the best
Jenna said, yes.
It's not the best case scenario for an opportunity. Yep. What was the opportunity? For example, I mentioned that I've been teaching online for the last 5 years, since when I moved to Scotland for my master's degree. When I was doing my master's degree in Scotland in 2012 and 2013, I started teaching online. So it's been quite a while. And then I saw that as an opportunity. And then actually 3 years ago, I took a specialization course at Iowa State University, using technology for ELT classes. So that was an opportunity that I saw. There was no pandemic. The only difference is that now we have a pandemic and we have no other option. We don't have another option.
This is the option we have now.
That's the option that we have now. So this is a mindset, okay? This is a mindset and it's flexible.
We can change it.
We can change it. Unless we say no, I'm not going to teach online. I'm not going to use resources. So unfortunately, I'm sorry, you're going to get fired because we don't have another option.
Henry summarized it spot on. He says, I see the whole situation as an opportunity for people to be prepared for this new generation in which technology will take a leading role in our lives. Exactly. Everybody needs to be up to date. Yes. And I always like to mention this book that I've been reading, 21 Lessons for the 21st Century, Yuval Harari, professor from Israel, the University of Jerusalem. And he says that with the new technologies coming, the artificial intelligence and algorithms, and we talked a little bit about this, a lot of jobs will become irrelevant. A lot of people will become irrelevant for the economy. But those jobs are the jobs that we can automatize. And then we are not going to go through that because we need rapport. We need human connection because that's what teaching and learning and education is about. It's about being connected and sharing experiences, especially for very young learners, right? Mm-hmm. So we just have to remember that it doesn't have to be 100% like that. We can work with the notion of blended learning and we can have a face-to-face element factor. And then we can have the online element of the classroom. And this is what the future is going to be like, you know. We're going to get together. We're going to have people teaching us face-to-face. But most of the learning we'll be doing online, you know. We're going to do a lot of online learning. So get ready. This is your opportunity.
Yeah, I mean, if we don't change now, when the heck are we going to change? Because, again, we don't have another way out. We have a pandemic. We cannot go to the classroom. We cannot go to schools anymore. So we need to use that. And that's going to force companies, because Henry said 5G is right on the corner. Yes, 5G is right around the corner. But not only this. Yeah. For instance, because we've been teaching online, this is going to force internet companies, mobile companies to improve their jobs and their services. Because we know that mobile connection sucks here in Brazil. We know that internet connection sucks in Brazil. So this is going to make them okay. So we need to make this faster. We need to improve our services as well. Yeah. So we only have one more minute.
Yeah. So basically the whole pandemic thing is going to make a lot of people revisit their biases. You know, they're going to have to rethink a lot of things. And hopefully this is going to start a positive movement. You know, if we can look on the bright side of this whole thing, maybe the bright side is this is the time for us to reinvent ourselves and become better professionals and become more human, even though we are apart, right? Because we're getting together, we're connecting to share resources. And this is wonderful. This is something that we can do through technology. So technology as a means, not as an end in itself, not using technology for the sake of technology, but using technology to achieve a goal. And we have 30 seconds now. So
guys, I guess we have to see. Thank you so much. If you have just arrived, this episode of Chá Pedagógico is going to be on IGTV on EDC Rocks. And I'm going to upload it to Spotify. So guys, go to Spotify, look for Marcello Consultoria or Chá Pedagógico on Spotify. It's going to be there as a podcast.
5 seconds.
Thank you so much.
Bye-bye, everybody.